You'll see we have a smaller board tonight due to illness and travel and circumstances beyond our control here. So I, as clerk, am stepping in as board president tonight for Mr. Unger, and Jim Quesenberry is serving as clerk. So welcome to the January 16, 2018 regular meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. We'll do our first item, 2.02, consensus on the order of business. When good? All right. Moving on to, we have some minutes to approve. Minutes of December. So the ones, people who are here, get ready to do some moving and seconding. It's all up to us. Approval of minutes from December 12, 2017.
I move approval.
And I'll second.
Any changes, corrections, revisions? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Mrs. Holmes, do I need to each time state who's absent, or can you? Thank you very much. Item 2.04, approval of minutes from December 14, 2017.
Madam President, I was not at that meeting, so I don't know that I can vote.
All right. Well, we may.
If we can.
We'll have to carry that over until next time then, because we lose our quorum. So
sorry.
That's all right. Mrs. Holmes will make a note to do that, I'm sure. Then we'll move on to 2.05, approval of the minutes from January 11, 2018.
I'll move the approval.
I'll second.
Catherine was
absent. Oh, yes,
you were
second.
Not here that meeting. Well, we still, we don't have a quorum to vote then. So we miss our three people. So those will, we will approve those minutes at our next regularly scheduled meeting. All right. And look, we're missing. Well, we will just ask Ritik to take it away.
Hello. So happy New Year, everyone. This is a crazy week at So High. We have our Rivals Week this week, which is basically we have a theme for each day where students can choose to either dress up as one thing or another. Today was mathlete versus athlete, hence my attire. It kind of carried over into my previous activity. But so today was mathlete versus athlete. Tomorrow is clash versus match. Thursday is look this up. Sorry, excuse me. I should probably know this. Thursday is slob versus snob. And then Friday is gold versus black, leading into our spirit rally. And then Saturday will be our winter formal dance, which is a galaxagally.
What is it?
A galaxagally.
Oh, okay.
So it's space-themed. We're going to have Star Wars and anything space you can think of. So ASB students are scrambling this week to take care of all the lunchtime activities and plan the dance for Saturday. And then half of our ASB was gone this weekend for something called Harvard Model Congress. And so we're just all recovering from that while trying to plan these days and get that dance for Saturday. So, yeah, that's ASB news. But right now, on the field, soccer is playing. Soccer has been doing amazing. They are 12-1, as well as the boys team is also 12-1. They were ranked number one in state for a little bit. So sports is doing outstanding. Last Friday was our Mission game, our home game against Mission, which we beat for the first time in 7 years. The guys were FaceTiming Noah Cracknell's mom. We were watching the game from San Francisco at Harvard Model Congress, and that hotel room went crazy after Mac McConnell made those free throws and gave us W. So right now, I'd say I'm probably the most proud I've ever been to be a Tiger. It is an amazing time to attend SLO High, and I'm sure many, many students feel the same way. On the note of Harvard Model Congress, I'd like to thank Black and Gold. I'm not sure if they get enough recognition for the amount of stuff and the donations that they give out to our clubs on campus. They gave Harvard Model Congress this year $4,000, but they've also donated to Latin Club, Slobotics, Mock Trial, and the list gets even longer. These organizations like Black and Gold and the Band Boosters and the Aggie Backers, they're really the organizations that keep our clubs running and let our students pursue their passions. If I may give an example, Black and Gold, my freshman year, when they donated money, to HMC, that organization has, or that club, I guess, has been the reason I've become so outward and more confident in my character, I guess, because when freshman year, I could not even recognize myself because I was so shy. And going into a conference where I was surrounded by Harvard students and very, very intellectual high school students, I was forced to step out of my comfort zone. And it's amazing that Black and Gold allows us and not to worry about finances to be able to step out of our comfort zones and pursue our passions. They've also donated microwaves, which we've installed outside of our library so students can heat up their food whenever they need to during lunch or during break. So our thanks cannot be given out enough, and we appreciate them a lot, and I'd like to recognize them at the school board. I was told, or I was walking in the ag department today, and I saw a table that Metal Shop and Wood Shop has been working on, which they plan to sell. This is a project that incorporates a handicap design to a table which they which they're going to sell to other places, I guess. And Pacific Beach is related somehow, but I'm not sure. I think they may be selling some of these tables to Pacific Beach. But it's an amazing design where the seats fold in, and it's really cool that Mr. Brewington and our metal teacher, Mr. Fay, are working together and incorporating students' designs to create a table. So our clubs are tremendous, and they are thriving. And another thing I was brought up a couple meetings ago was the name Powder Puff. So I went and talked to some students on campus and how they felt about that name. But I think the general consensus was that there's a lack of information regarding the background of the name. So if you may look unfavorably upon that name, or if there is a negative connotation, maybe if we want to change it, we educate students on its origins. But as of now, I don't know if any students mind the origins of the name. That's just answering your question. I'm not sure if that answered it, but I can definitely ask around more if you need it.
Thank you.
Of course. So that's what's going on at Slow High. Actually, one more thing. Sorry. Tomorrow is our student congress meeting, which a student from each class at the school meets in our electrodemo room at a meeting ran by Minori, our vice president, and she basically gets input from all the students. The administrators are there. Mr. Brand, our athletic director, is there. And the students just basically hit us with all of their problems and whatever we need to address. And it's amazing because students actually get a voice to tell their representatives. The representatives come and voice their concerns directly to the administration or ASB or the athletic director. And we address those issues at the next meeting to see how we put our efforts in to solve them. So that's a really important thing that's happening tomorrow. But other than that, Superintendent Senate's meeting tomorrow. I'll see you there with Dr. Prater. But thank you. That's my report.
Thank you, and thank you for all your recognition of the clubs and the boosters and the various departments and what they do to contribute to the school atmosphere and culture. Catherine, did you have?
Ritiki, you look particularly sharp tonight. Did you do something special today?
Yes, I had well, this was my Mathlete costume. I was trying to dress nerdy, but it kind of worked really well because I didn't have to change my Princeton interview, which I just came from in Avila.
Yes, Ritika, I want to thank you for your excellent summary of the events going on at the school and your recognition of the clubs. I just want to mention while we're here that both San Luis High and Morro Bay High do a great job of raising funds for various charities. I know that the Morro Bay FFA was raising money for the victims of the Thomas Fire. And I'm sure there are very similar things going at San Luis High, but I thought I'd want to mention that. And then to the subject of Powder Puff football, as a former player and coach, and I've officiated a few of those matches. And matter of fact, my daughters participated, and I can tell you that it's some pretty fearsome football that's played. Anyway, thank you, Ritik.
So as you know, sounds like you've had a long and interesting day, but you may wish to get on home to relax at this time, so feel free to move along should you wish to. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Next, we have a presentation from the Morro Bay High School and San Luis High FFA Student Achievements.
Hello, my name is Cheyenne Chacon, and I'm a senior at Morro Bay.
And I'm Emily Wold, and I'm also a senior at Morro Bay.
So we're here to talk to you about National Convention, which was October 23rd through the 29th. Katrina Seams won National Profession in the area of vet science. She was up against three other people from different states who had also won their local, regional, and state, which made them eligible to compete at nationals. She received two plaques and $1,000. This is the first time in a long time that someone in our chapter has won a national title.
She went there along with three other students. It was Tiffany Reveille, Haley Reveille, and Emmy Haas. Unfortunately, they could not make it here today, but they put together a video to show you guys what they learned and earned doing there.
Hi, my name is Katrina Seams, and I recently won the National FFA Proficiency for Veterinary Science. That summer, I got a call from Ms. Flynn saying that I was a national finalist. So this meant that I was one of the top four in the nation for this area of veterinary science. And so in October, I, along with three other members of my chapter, flew out to Indianapolis. I stood for nothing, so I fell for everything. You held me down, but I got up, already brushing off the dust. You hear my voice, you hear that sound, like thunder gonna shake the ground. You held me down, but I got up.
The opportunity of traveling to Indianapolis is and will be my greatest memory of high school. Everything was so beautiful and different than what we used to in California. Every single person in Indianapolis was so supportive of the FFA and happy for us to be there. It was such an inspiring environment.
Really crazy. It was about over 12,000 people, I think, in the giant auditorium stage area, and so they lined us up and gave us our finalist plaques, and then came the announcement of the winner, and they brought us to the front of the stage. It was so crazy hearing my name called. I never expected that one. Just being the first in the nation for that area, you hear about, like, other people doing it. But it's crazy to hear your name called.
Thank you.
Going to National Convention has helped our chapter because we brought back stuff we learned from the College and Career Expo, workshops, and other chapters from around the U.S. This was such a good opportunity, and I learned so much.
So that moment when all of your work pays off, the stress and the long nights and the sacrifices you make for that one thing makes it all totally worth it. This proficiency in this job is what really inspired me to come to UC Davis as an animal science major, and I hope to one day become a veterinarian. It's given me really everything, the dedication you need, the knowledge, even the funds, and just something to be proud of and remember.
And I'd like to take a moment to introduce Ariana King. She's a junior at San Luis Obispo High School, and she is quite an accomplished young lady in FFA at San Luis Obispo High. So thank you for coming tonight, Ari, and please, would you share a few things with us? All right, there you go.
Good evening, everyone. Recently, my partner Lily Svetich and I also went to Indianapolis, Indiana, to present our agriscience research project, which is a project where we picked an agricultural topic. For us, it was in the social division. They also have plant divisions and farm power divisions and animal divisions, but ours was about social systems. So what our project was we evaluated through a survey how well third grade students would retain information regarding healthy eating habits following a lesson about healthy eating and vegetables. With childhood obesity being such a widespread problem in the U.S., we wanted to do something that would allow us to see the effects of a nutrition-based curriculum on today's youth. During our preliminary research, we found a study by Virginia Tech where they assessed preschoolers' vegetable recognition abilities. MyPlate.gov also provides comprehensive activities and worksheets relating to nutrition. Despite MyPlate.gov's efforts, obesity rates still stand. We wanted to create an experiment that would allow us to see the effect of a nutrition-based curriculum on our community at the third grade age, for we feel that third grade is approximately the time where students begin to make independent decisions regarding what they eat. So during our experiment, our initial step was to administer and collect the surveys and gather data for our project. After that, we did several activities with the students, including a paper plate activity where we gave them a paper plate and we split it up into different chunks and we had them color each section what related to their diet. So for an example, they would color a section of a plate that they would eat grains, orange, and a section of a plate that they would eat vegetables, green. And another thing we did after that was we had vegetable bingo, and we gave them a lecture on vitamins and made it pretty engaging and participatory where they could all talk about how vitamins apply to their lives and how it helps them do healthy things and run, and it really increased their knowledges of why vegetables are good for them. Following that, we gave them an educational video, which was a song about vegetables, and then we had the Veggie Olympics. What that allowed us to do was we had them split up into teams, and they would tally each time they got a point for, like, participating well or answering a question correctly. And one of our big competitions was vegetable bingo, and also we had a trivia. And during this trivia, we were really able to discuss with the students the importance of agriculture in the community. Our goal in this project was to promote ag literacy amongst the youth of our community. With only 2% of Americans coming from a farming background, the disconnect between production of food and consumption is clear. With agriculture being such a prominent part of San Luis Obispo's economy, we felt that it was important for the students to realize that vegetables are not only an important part of their diets, but vital to the community as well. We asked the students what agriculture was and had them attempt to explain it for themselves. There's a vast range of responses, from what's agriculture to a fairly accurate description of production agriculture. We then summarized agriculture for the students and asked how it applied in their everyday lives. Some students came from farming backgrounds, but they were still able to learn more about how it applies to them. Those who did not know about agriculture were intrigued and told about how it works, and they were eager to learn more. During this project, we found that we were successful because overall, the majority of our results, they had retained the information after we gave them the survey again 1 month later. We went back to their classrooms and gave the survey to the teachers and then collected it, and we decided upon 1 month because they wouldn't have immediately just remembered the information right after we had told it to them. But 1 month was about a time where they may have forgot it or they may have remembered it, but they imagined to remember the information and also incorporate their diets into their everyday lives that we taught them with the vegetables. So thank you so much for listening. Does anyone have any questions?
Any questions from the board? Okay. It doesn't look like it.
But Ari, can you tell the board some of the accolades that you've won through the years through FFA?
Yes. Well, our sophomore year, our parliamentary procedure team went to nationals, and we got second place in the nation there. We were first place in the test. And our freshman year, we had won state in the parliamentary procedure event. And this year, we got second in the nation for our agri-science research project in the social divisions category.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you. That sounds really interesting and fun for, I would hope, for you and the students as well.
It was lots of fun. Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. All right. Our next topic is 3.03, Measure D, Citizens Bond Oversight Committee. And it's my understanding Mr. Sanfilippo will be presenting.
Yeah, so our chairman, Mr. Sanfilippo, is here to kind of just touch base with the board over the course of the year. And, you know, as part of the Measure D bond measure, we have to have a Citizens Bond Oversight Committee, which basically, you know, oversees all of the expenditures of Measure D funds. So without any further ado, Ken's going to give you a rundown on the annual report.
Thank you. And you know, it's always a hard act to follow when you have to follow the FFA. Because most of you know I was a former ag teacher and former FFA member, so
right.
It hits home. And I want to thank the board for all the support they've done with all the vocational programs. So this is what you get, great leadership and great things that happen. I'm here alone tonight, but I want to at least recognize our committee members. Once again, I'll introduce myself to you, Ken Sanfilippo. I'm the chair. But our members consist of Chris Delaney, Jolie Ditmore, Christopher Lopez, Jeannie Potter, Dr. Jim Stanfill, and Roya Silver, who's left us this year, so we have a vacancy. But I really want to commend the panel members. They've been we meet quarterly. They've been at all the meetings. They come prepared. And I want to thank also the board and that works with us, the support staff that presents us with all the documents and advance notice. So it's a great great place to be. Great things are happening, and it's a great committee and so on. I also want to emphasize, because I think that's important, that we do comply with the Brown Ralph M. Brown Act, our Public Meetings Act. We have our formally scheduled meetings with agendas, and the information is open to the public. We're transparent with the public. They want to come and talk with us. Our meetings are scheduled on a quarterly basis, and like I said, our members are in attendance and prepared. We hadn't any special meetings, but I hear about all your special meetings as far as you know, what you're working with as far as the bond project. So what do we do besides meet and look at all this data and so on? So you got the report, but I'll just read a couple quotes from that. The Oversight Committee reviews financial expenditures, and we do have accountants on this panel, by the way, for Measure D proceeds. We review all the actions that the board makes related to compliance with Educational Code 15278. The expanded reports that the Citizen Oversight Committee is provided summarize all the activities with vendor and amounts of each payment. And our most recent expenditure reports that we reviewed by the committee reviewed relative to the reporting period was ending June 30th, 2017. And of course, all these reports, as you know, are made available for the public review and are attached to this annual report. You know, I have a long history in San Luis Obispo, a long history with the district, a long history with other districts as I left San Luis Coastal. And being the transparency part is real important to me, and getting the information that you're doing about our bond, how the bond is being spent, goes miles. And I really want to commend on the folks that work with us that's happening. And we have our local businesses are competitive and getting contracts with that. So a lot of good things are happening. I've always been proud to say I work for San Luis Coastal. I'm proud to be on this committee, and I think we're doing great things for our community. And I know the time and effort that you're all putting in to make things happen for young people, people of the future that will be in San Luis Coastal School District. So, any questions? We're all good?
Any questions
from the
board?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much. Okay, at this time, this is our time for public comment. If anyone has an item they would like to discuss now, let us know. Or if you would prefer to wait until the item comes up on the agenda, you can do that. We do have some yellow slips. We would request, although it's not required, that you complete a form just so we know how many people we're expecting and can call your name. Is there anyone who would like to speak now, or do you wish to wait until the agenda item appears? Mrs. Neuhauser, we will ask Mrs. Holmes to put 3 minutes up on the clock, please.
My name is Judy Neuhauser. I'm here during public comment time to talk about public comment. I'm going to urge the board to preserve the ability of the public to use charts, graphs, and other visual materials during their public comments. Dr. Prater's letter of January 9th indicated that there will be a board committee that will be reviewing the use of visuals in public comment. The Brown Act requires that all public boards permit the public to address the board in open session. Dr. Prater indicated that the district lawyer says that the board committee may interpret the word address in this way, and I'm going to quote from the letter. The requirement that members of the public address the legislative body refers to the right to speak during public comment portion of the agenda. This right does not extend to video presentations with the use of technology like PowerPoint. I thought the Supreme Court was pretty clear in saying that public speech actually included money and all sorts of other things. So I'm a little confused by that. I would say that view is far from being settled or even is common understanding. The League of California Cities document entitled Open and Public For, Guide to the Ralph M. Brown Act, you'll find the following answer to what they refer to as a frequently asked question. And here's the question. Must the legislative body allow members of the public to show videos or make a PowerPoint presentation during the public comment part of the agenda, as long as the subject matter is relevant to the agency and is within the established time limit? The answer is probably, although the agency is under no obligation to provide equipment. It's on page 30. I think it would be wise for this board to avoid narrowing the scope of public comment in this time of major funding changes for the district. You need to foster the trust of the public and to gather as much good information, data, and perspective as possible to make just and wise decisions. I would point out that your staff makes heavy use of graphs and data, charts, video, and that's totally appropriate because these are very complex issues that you're addressing. And the public would like the same ability to help you understand what our perspective and how we see the data. And we can't do that, and we can't educate the public also on that if we can't use the public presentation of visuals. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else who wishes to address the public at this time? Thank you. Next,
Madam President.
Oh, yes.
I just want clarification here.
You.
If I have a re- request from Becky Wells. Is she going to speak on the at the Cal Cards or now? You'd write. Okay, that's fine. And then Judy, you're reserving the right to also speak on the elementary achievement. Okay. And all right.
Thank you for clarifying that, Mr. Pleasantberry. All right.
So my minutes are going now before I'm talking.
No, we're trying to take care of our technology here.
Perfect.
Just one moment.
Thank you.
Okay.
So
thank
I'm
you.
Becky Wells from Los Osos, and I'm a stakeholder, a property taxpayer. I also had to write everything down so I wouldn't forget one word. So I left the last meeting thinking about the Blue Ribbon Committee assessment on our bleak budget, which highlighted layoffs, overcrowded classrooms, and school closures. We've been hearing this for the last year, right? I mean, we know it's coming. And this was followed with information about CalCard transactions and bank statements. I've spent hours combing the statements and sharing the statements. The optics really are appalling. Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars are being spent on food alone. From someone's lunch at Splash Cafe for $13 to $700 taquerias, and let's not forget spirit and bottled liquor. So there's also Bass Lake Resort, $1,200 there. My principal has restrictions on purchasing food for our students. The PTA is now fundraising, and I tell you, we work really hard to get the money we have, to provide milk and cookies for literacy night. For literacy night, she cannot buy milk and cookies. While the district has continued to buy food for themselves. So now we're going to go into non-food purchases. They're as concerning as well. My examples are Target, thousands of dollars on Amazon Marketplace, the Disneyland Hotel on June 24th. The list goes on. I'm sure that there are really valid explanations, I'm hoping. But the optics, again, are not good. So this leads me to questions. How many Cal Cards are in our district? Who's making decisions on who should have these Cal Cards? What are the rules and guidelines for expenditures on these Cal Cards? And where can we find the rules and the guidelines on how our money is to be used for our children? Who oversees the itemized receipts? Are the board members getting the itemized receipts? Are we spending time with itemized receipts? Where can we find itemized receipts? Let's see. I think this is really important to make sure that all of our transactions are valid and ethical and in the children's best interest. The optics look to me as that the controls need to be reviewed and that transparency is needed, more transparency is needed. I think when we're looking at upping our property taxes and I'm seeing all of this going on, there's no way I want to give one more dollar.
Ms. Wells, you have about 10 seconds to conclude, please.
I'm going to wrap it up right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else at this time? All right. Now it's time for our superintendent's updates. Oh, Mr. Quisenberry, sorry.
For clarification purposes, Dr. Prater, do we have any charges on CalCards for alcohol?
To my knowledge, no. That would be illegal.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move on at this time, but we have heard your comments and appreciate them. Thank you.
The governor put forward his proposed budget for the year. So, we're kind of on, a positive economy in terms of California and how things are going. So throughout, it was interesting, again, in that the governor, as he proceeded to talk about, more money to the government, more expenditures for education and different programs, also continues to talk about, they're at some point we're in the longest kind of expansion of the economy since World War II, and at some point there will be some type of a downfall. So we'll see what happens. That said, in terms of what it looks like for this coming year, it's really positive. In particular for state-funded districts. So the governor is going to fully fund LCFF, which is the local control funding formula, which is the amount that each district gets per student. So that's a really nice increase for a lot of districts in the state. Doesn't really affect us because we're a basic aid school district, but does help other districts. You know, several other items that kind of came out of it we will receive some one-time funding, it looks like. Now, what that ends up being, which is a huge positive for us, and that, I think, without the mitigation money from Diablo Canyon, should help us in terms of next year. We were looking at upwards to a $3 million potential deficit expenditures revenues for next year. So it looks like we could, based on the governor's proposed, get about $2 million, which would, you know, kind of lessen the impact of the actual cuts that we would need to make for next year. So that was a big positive, and hopefully that will continue on. Tax receipts won't decline in such a way over the next few months it takes away from those one-time funds. The governor did put a 2.5% COLA into it, so that actually takes that base amount for students and increases that. But all of the district programs like special education and things for us also would receive that COLA. So there are some helpful budgetary, you know, scenarios within the budget itself for that. It was interesting also in that the governor, you know, he started out, Governor Brown had a $35 billion debt that the state of California had. And so he's kind of winnowed that down to $6 million now over the course of the years. He's also built up a rainy day fund in terms of if the economy does suffer to help through those time periods. So a lot of positives, I would say, in this overall budget that kind of came out from the governor. So what happens now is the governor puts a proposal, then they have what's called the May revise, which is kind of a check-in. How's the economy doing? Is everything still fine? And then the governor and the state passes the budget then before July 1. So that's kind of that process that happens. So this, but again, a positive, I would say, overall. The one thing that was kind of interesting when I read through a lot of the governor's information is he talks about pensions and how he's helped to bring pensions, help them become better funded long term. And so it was just an interesting dynamic because really that came on the back of school districts in terms of that expenditure did to do that. So while a lot of money is kind of coming into education, there's still that expenditure increase that, again, we're seeing that increase over the next few years. It is interesting, and I know we have a resolution tonight on the board. California still ranks, I believe, 45th in the nation in terms of even with these increases in LCFF and these things. So still 45th in the nation in terms of overall student funding. So it's just an interesting dynamic in terms of looking at the, you know, all the optics. So it's going to be interesting for us, I think, as a district, as we begin to talk about cuts and loss of revenue, those types of things, where most of the districts in our county that are state funded are going to be seeing some really good increases. So that it's going to be an interesting time, I think, over the next year or two, as for San Luis Coastal is, you know, when you hear about the news and those types of things. So we'll see how that goes. The retirement impact will at some point catch up with all of those districts as well. So this will probably be kind of that cap to the positive, you know, a lot of increases in funding that's going to happen for state funded districts. And then over time, everyone's going to kind of feel that pension pain over the next few years.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. Before we move on, I realized that I skipped 4.02 correspondence. At the time the agenda went out, there was no correspondence to go with the agenda. I know we have received some since then, but not at the time of the agenda. Does anyone?
I received an email from Judy Neuhauser
I believe
regarding the public comment.
Right. I believe we all did. All right. Thank you. And next, educational services update. Ms. McGrath.
Thank you. I have two things to share with you tonight, one good news and one maybe not so good news. So we'll start with the not so good news. A little disappointing. Last week we had a decision from the California Public Utilities Commission. So the commission heard our joint proposal that we had together with the county, the cities, and ourself, as well as PG&E's employee retention program. So although the commission did increase the amount of funding for the PG&E employee retention program, it was disappointing to hear that they did rule and agreed with the administrative law judge to not use ratepayer funding in order to pay for the settlement agreement that we came to and proposed to the California Public Utilities Commission. So disappointing to hear that. They did note in their decision that they did not feel they had legislative authority in order to make that decision. So we've done everything we can to present our arguments and our case to that commission. And so since they noted that they didn't have a legislative authority, we will begin to do our best to talk to legislatures and work through that legislative process in order to keep fighting for our district and what's best for our kids. So that is our next step that we will work towards. I'll end on a little bit better note. On Friday, we had two excellent examples of professional development for our teachers. So first of all, every elementary site participated in kind of an innovative, modern way to receive professional development. This was a webinar developed by our elementary teacher on special assignment, Diana Jones, and she developed a webinar on the topic of conferring with students during reading time and developed that and then sent it out for sites to participate in at their sites. So great use of technology and a great way to get professional development to an abundance of teachers at the same time. So kudos to her, as well as over 200 elementary teachers actually right here in this room participated in an excellent professional development that really focused on student behaviors in a general education classroom and what strategies could be used in order to address those student behaviors. The topic was when your usual bag of tricks doesn't work, behavioral interventions that help all students succeed. So a big thanks to Diane Frost for organizing that and Amy Shields to providing these great opportunities for our teachers. There'll also be some follow-up with sites in order to kind of take the next steps and help teachers to implement those strategies. So we'll end on a good note.
Thank you. And our Measure D update.
So yeah, on the Measure D front, we had an outstanding meeting with our design-build contractor and architect last week, met with the sites, kind of checked in from our design development phase and the projects surrounding that, and got site input to, hey, you know, we've been going through this, but let's sit back together, go over the entire plan, every classroom, what's the plan, what are we doing? So very productive, and I think we're at a point now where it's kind of taking that next step in terms of construction docs. A lot of projects going on right now, a lot of construction happening, which is, finally having that momentum of things getting done in classrooms and is very exciting. And then lastly, we are taking every opportunity we can to supplement our Measure D funding. So anything we can do to go out there and find more funds, which is a positive. And so currently we have about 7 CTE applications for state funding to help with some of the state bond that was passed. And so that's a process that's going to hit us pretty quick. So we put all those applications in before November 30th. And then we're supposed to hear February 14th. Kind of what the status is, and there's a really quick 2-week turnaround in terms of the documentation and paperwork that you have to make sure that you receive those funds and kind of follow up. So kudos to Kelly Lee over at the, in our BG&T department. We'll be bringing Mr. Bonin in, director, to kind of help with that process as well. But we're also using Julie Avnet through Spectrum Solutions to help Kelly pull it all together. So our goal is to have all of that prepared, whether we, receive those awards or not on the 14th, and make sure that we're ready to move forward. So we're excited about where we're headed. And then I'll end on the fact that we did start, and I think this is Mr. Quisenberry about to press his button, the Morro Bay City swim program at the Morro Bay Pool started last Monday. So they have some, lap swim, different activities starting. So, again, it's just the beginning of kind of, working together. We already had an agreement with the city on facility use, and the city's rented out our gyms, and we have a daycare program, different types of things anyway, so that wasn't really an issue. We tried to come to a cost associated with, I called other districts to kind of find, costs that made sense, and so we're excited to have, the city programs in the pool and, being able to kind of move forward with that. So It was a positive, I think, last week. There's some little kinks here and there that we're still figuring out, the light system and, those types of things. But overall, I think it'll just build in the future looking forward to some weekend events and different types of things for the community to be involved in as well.
So, Mr. Pinkerton, if someone from the public wants to know about, let's say, Lap Swim or something like that, they'll call Morro Bay Department.
The Morro Bay Recreation.
Right. Thank you.
Department.
Well, thank you. We'll look forward to hearing about all the grants we'll be awarded. Thank you. All right. Next is 6.01, a resolution. Dr. Prater.
Good evening, Board. I was hoping to gain your support in approving this resolution for full and fair funding of California's public schools. This goes well beyond even the latest news with Diablo Canyon for us. This has just been a long-standing issue as an educator in California, where we know that California is the sixth largest economy in the world. We know that the brain power and talent pool in California is unlike any other state in our nation, in my opinion. At the same time, California's public schools receive, like you heard from Mr. Pinkerton, near the bottom 10 in the nation in per pupil funding. And you cannot separate out that lack of investment, if you will, in an outcome. There has to be attention given to that. California School Boards Association has put together this resolution in the hope of getting all school districts in California to support it so that they can begin to push forward with some sort of legislative response that says, look, let's invest in our public schools so that we are not confronted with these very difficult choices. And our kids deserve better. So what you have here in front of you is a resolution developed and designed by California School Board Association. And I would leave it in your capable hands to render your thoughts and opinions.
Discussion among the board?
Well, I want to speak on behalf of the resolution, and I'm almost tempted to ask to permission to read it in so that the public can see it, because I noticed in looking at our board meetings that this screen does not always show up. So it's up to the board. If they feel it's necessary, I would like to read it, but if not,
Here's a hard copy, Jim, if this is easier.
Okay. So this is calling for the full and fair funding of California's public schools. Whereas California has the sixth largest economy in the world and the largest gross domestic product of any state in the nation, and whereas despite California's leadership in the global economy, the state falls in the nation's bottom quintile on nearly every measure of public K-12 school funding and staffing. And whereas California ranks 45th nationally in the percentage of taxable income spent on education, 41st in per pupil spending, 45th in pupil teacher ratios, and 48th in pupil staff ratios. And whereas K-12 school funding has not substantially increased on an inflation adjusted basis for more than a decade. And whereas the local control funding formula, state funding for K-12 schools has only this year recently returned to levels predating the Great Recession of 27. And whereas the modest revenue increases since the implementation of LCFF have been eroded by rapidly increasing costs for health care, pensions, transportation, and utilities. And whereas 58% of California's public school students are eligible for free and reduced price lunch, 13% above the national average, and 23% of California students are English learners, more than twice the national average. And whereas California's investment in public schools is out of alignment with its wealth, its ambitions, its demographics, and the demand of the 21st century education, and whereas in 2007, a bipartisan group of California leaders commissioned a report titled Getting Down to the Facts, which stated that it would take an additional $17 billion annually to meet the State Board of Education achievement targets for K-12 schools. And whereas in 2016, a California School Boards Association report, California's Challenge, Adequately Funding Education in the 21st Century, updated the Getting Down to Facts data and determined that adjusting for inflation, an additional $22 billion to $40 billion annually would be required to provide all public school students with access to high-quality education. And whereas California funds schools at roughly $1,961 per student less than the national average, which translates to approximately $3,462 per student when adjusted for California being a high-cost state, and whereas California trails the average of the top 10 states by almost $7,000 in per-pupil spending, and whereas the Robles versus the state of Robles-Wong versus the state of California, a group of plaintiffs led by CSBA argued that California's school funding system violated Article 9 of the state constitution by denying all students access to an education that prepares them for economic security and full participation in our democratic institutions. And whereas the California Supreme Court declined to hear the case by a 4-3 margin, prompting Justice Goodwin H. Liu to write, "It's regrettable that this court, having recognized education as a fundamental right in a landmark decision 45 years ago, that decision is Serrano versus Priest, should now decline to address the substantive meaning of that right. And whereas in order to prepare our students for participation in a democratic society and an increasingly competitive, technology-driven global economy, California must fund schools at a level sufficient to support student success. And whereas despite its vast wealth, California has consistently underfunded public education while widening its scope, adding new requirements, and raising standards without providing appropriate resources to prepare all students for college, career, and civic life. And whereas if California is close to opportunity and achievement gaps, if California is to close opportunity and achievement gaps and create public school system that offers consistently high levels of education, the state must provide schools with the resource to meet the needs of their specific populations. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the governing board of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District urges the state legislature to fund California public schools at the national average or higher by the year 2020, and at a level that is equal to or above the average of the top 10 states nationally by 2025, and to maintain at a minimum, this level of funding unless otherwise decreed.
Is there anyone from the public who wishes to address this item? We'll come back to the board. Any further discussion or a motion?
Well done. I'm very glad you read every word of that, Jim, particularly well to history and English teacher that you are. And I'd like to move approval of this resolution.
Can I have a second, please?
Mrs. Holmes? This is a roll call vote, it's my understanding.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Aye.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Passes 4-0 with 3 absences.
Right. Now, I have a blue agenda here, but the one on the screen is a little different. So it's my understanding. Right. Okay. Yeah. No. All right. Next item is the amendment to the lease agreement, Avila Schoolhouse property. Always a favorite topic.
We're back again, talk about the Avila property. So the good news is we do have 5 units that are, you know, paying the district and bringing revenue into the district, which is great. We actually have 2 revenue enhancement agenda items tonight, which is fantastic. This one along with Cayucas, which you'll hear about very soon. So Ty is here to talk about it. I know the board, we had a study session, kind of went over everything. So what I'd like to do is kind of have Ty, you know, put a ribbon on this in terms of just a quick, you know, what does this agreement do? What does it mean? In a nutshell for me, in terms of looking at the whole thing, what this does is it ensures the completion of the entire project. So by agreeing to this, we're making sure that the money is there to finish the old schoolhouse renovation, to make sure that we then, and again, the district receives income from each one of the units on the site. And the way that this lease is set up, that income goes directly to our general fund, which helps all of our kids.
We're actually dealing with the albatross of the old schoolhouse here. And it's an expensive process to rehabilitate, and the developers come to us and said, rather than lease out these next three units I'd like to do what I did on the first four, and that's to sell the long-term leases. So what they do is we've entered into a 99-year lease with the developer, and which is Sheer Edge, and they come to us and say they sell those leases instead of just leasing them out. We still get $800 a month per unit we've been getting six for the ones that are done. For the new units, we'll get $800 a unit. But what we've done here to try to make this project which is really focusing on the schoolhouse, is by allowing them to sell these three units, the money from that has to be used to fix the schoolhouse. So they get to pay off, you know, it's their profits that get to be used. And what they do is they take that money, the funds from those sales, put it into an account to come up, make sure that the project gets done, and then they're supposed to do the project. If they don't do the project, they have to give us half the money. So there's a real incentive for them to go out and do the project and get the schoolhouse finished. That would, the schoolhouse has, I believe, seven units inside of it, and we get 8% of the, it's going to be a bed and breakfast type thing or a hotel, and we get 8% of the revenue, gross revenue from that, or $250 a month, whichever is greater. And there's also the prospect of two to three additional transient lodging units that would go on the second parcel. So there's a lot of moving parts here, but what we're really trying to do is get that schoolhouse developed for the community who wanted it developed, and also for us so that we can generate revenue. So are there any questions? I'm happy to answer them.
Mr. Green, the account that you referred to, or the money from the sale, that's a joint account?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
That there, it's proposed, thank you, that the development entity be changed.
They want
with the same principles, but just a name change on the LLC. What's your understanding about that?
I think it's a tax issue or a funding issue for them. It's the fundamental thing for us is, I don't want to say I don't care because I do, but under the assignment agreement, the original entity stays responsible for everything anyway. So we're really, it's just kind of we're allowing them to be flexible in how they finance this thing and fund it. But from our point of view, we're not letting the first guys off the hook either. It's the same people, but the first entity is still responsible too. So you've actually got more entities lined up. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
If there are
It's one last question. What kind of timeline do you really realistically think we're looking at?
I don't even want to guess. I had hair when we started this. I think with the economy the way it is, and I think the developer is pushing to get this going, getting it done. I think they want to start on it as quick as they can, and they're ready to go. So I would hope to see this thing done before we hit another recession. That would be, I guess, the best I can put it. It's been years. And then it was a victim of a couple of things. One of them, I don't want to say, it's not fair to say it was a victim, but the community had some concerns about what would happen with the schoolhouse. That changed the project dramatically. And then it was a victim of the economy in 2007 that they kind of everything stopped for a while. So it's just kind of been, it's not the longest, oldest real estate project in the county, but it's not the youngest either. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to discuss this item? All right, we'll come back to the board. Mrs. Rogers, will you?
If there's no further board discussion, I'd like to move approval then of, what are we calling this?
Amendment to lease agreement, Avalo Schoolhouse.
Amendment to lease agreement, Avalo Schoolhouse property, Yeah, I guess that's all I have to say. I'd like to make that motion.
I'll second.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. All right. Our next item, 7.02, is approval of the MOU for student transfers among Cayucos Coast Unified SLC-USD. And we
do have certified.
Yeah.
So I would like to begin this by appreciating some work that has been very important behind the scenes. And this has been the topic of students specifically from Cayucos who graduate or move on from eighth grade and move on to high school. And for years, decades, there's been a boundary requirement where students from Cayucos Elementary School District attend Coast Unified High School Unified School District, which would be their high school in Cambria. Knowing that Morro Bay High School is 4 miles from Cayucos, you can actually see the high school from the town itself, or at least you can see the outline of it. I was able to fully capture the importance of wanting, if I was a resident of Cayucos and my children were growing up there, it doesn't take long to realize that Cayucos and Morro Bay have become part of a same Estero Bay community. And over the years, we've wrestled with how to best mitigate that situation. And the reason being is that all three districts, San Luis Coastal, Cayucos Elementary, and Coast Unified, are basic aid school districts. They're the only basic aid school districts in the county, and as such, the way we receive our funding is from local property tax. And so when it's counterintuitive, it took me a while to realize this, we are in a situation in San Luis Coastal, as they are in all basic aid districts, that the more students you have in the district, the less money per pupil you receive. It's a simple math equation. So when students from Cayucos request transfer into San Luis Coastal, that is a financial decision as well as an educational one. And while we love the community of Cayucos, we embrace them as our own, we also recognize that there's an obligation that goes with that. So behind the scenes, Mr. Smith, the superintendent from Cayucos, when he arrived, he and I got to know each other and spent some time, had some coffee, and were able to really talk about this issue at length. And both of us were very much interested in a solution that made sense, that wasn't just good for one side and not good for the other, that somehow this had to be an agreement that made sense, both from someone who was outside of the knowledge of all this, that money somehow followed the students. And so kudos to Scott Smith and the school board in Cayucos for sort of initiating these discussions. And so we've been in conversation for quite some time. The MOU that is before you tonight is something that I feel strongly about. Is it perfect? No. However, I do believe it represents what all three districts could conceivably live with and could resolve a multi-decade issue that has caused hardship, that has caused great amounts of frustration and hostility, and it has, in fact, created lasting hard feelings among the communities. And I'm here to say that all three communities of Cayucos, San Luis Coastal, and Coast, there's wonderful people wanting to do the best by their kids, and I stand by that. This MOU reflects give and take, I believe. It represents, I think, fairness, and it resolves a long-standing issue that Cayucos students when they leave eighth grade, or when in this MOU's case, if they chose to, if San Luis Coastal students in sixth grade wish to go to Cayucas for middle school, they would have that ability, and we would pay to have that child go to Cayucas, and vice versa, if Cayucas were to want to go to San Luis Coastal schools, and in grades 6 through 12. So this reflection, or this MOU, reflects a whole lot of conversation, much dialogue, much in-depth debate, and I'm here with you tonight. We reviewed this in a board study session last week, and I feel that after our attorney reviewed it, we sent it to Cayucas and Coast for their people to review it. And like I said, while it's not perfect, this MOU, in my opinion, is worthy of your approval. I think it is a positive thing, and we can move on the three districts of San Luis Coastal, Cayucas, and Coast, assuming their districts approve it. We would be able to move along starting in the 18-19 school year, incrementally over a three-year period to be fully funded. And it's based on the LCFS base amount and 25%. So I believe it's fair. I believe it's appropriate. And I think our communities, by and large, will appreciate the effort and the resolution that's in this MOU. And so I leave it with you for your discussion and hopeful action. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have someone from the public. Mrs. Holmes will need, when she gets up, to have our 3 minutes. And Mr. Quesenberry?
Yes, Carrie Friend has asked to address the board on this. Okay, and we hear Scott Smith would also like to address the board. Great, thank you.
Can I go? Okay. I want to acknowledge before I start that I am on the Cayuga School Board. I'm Carrie Friend. But according to our board policy 9010 on public statements, I want to be clear that I'm speaking on my own viewpoint. These are not viewpoints of my board. I think the MOU is a good starting point, and it is definitely a step in the right direction. However, I think there's still some kinks that need to be worked out. It doesn't guarantee that students that apply for an IDT or new district transfer are going to get them. Item 4 says, each district agrees to comply with the provisions of the California Ed Code that lists the sections and its own district policy regarding interdistrict transfers of students, including policy provisions regarding terms and conditions under which permits may be permitted, denied, or revoked. Signing this MOU does not mean that said districts are going to release their students. If a district says, you know, I really don't want to pay that much right now, I'm not going to release my students, then we're in the same pickle that we're in right now. So as this MOU stands, that doesn't fix that really problem if a district would like to not send money to another district. They just simply refuse. The changes in basic aid status hasn't been fully considered. According to item 14, at the end, if a district falls out of basic aid status, they get to withdraw. Well, let's explore that. Let's say you fall out of basic aid status, which has been in the papers. That's a possibility. So you know you would welcome kids because you get money from the state. So if you're out of it, that means Cayucas and Coast are still part of the contract. Does that mean Coast still sends money to San Luis Coastal because they're still bound to this? That's not clear. What happens with basic aid status? So if somebody falls out of basic aid, in my opinion, it should make this whole contract null and void because there's all kinds of ramifications. Okay, let's play that a different way. If Coast falls out of basic aid, they're not releasing. You know, if Cayucas falls out of basic aid, Cayucas might not release. So as well as this is a step in the right direction, it doesn't, that last part of just saying that one district can get out, what do those other two districts do then? So that's kind of, that needs to be fixed. Because any district that falls out of basic aid will most likely not do that, not release. As far as basic aid, there's also other issues going on. As the Cayucas board passed a resolution to also look into K-12 self-unification, and there's some legislation. Out of control of the school districts is legislation. Let's say that let's say legislation passes to let us change a feeder pattern from Cayucas now to San Luis Coastal, and there's a successful petition. The districts have no control over that. There's nothing in here that says if that happens, that that will change. So it has been going on for over 2 decades. I urge you to not approve this in haste tonight when there's so many other issues that I think are huge. And also, you have 4 members here tonight. Something that's huge like this, that's going to be such a huge policy, all your board members, I would like to weigh in on that, I would like to see. So thank you for your time and consideration.
Good evening, Dr. Prater, Ms. McGrath, Mr. Pinkerton, and board trustees. My name is Scott Smith, superintendent in Cayucas, and just appreciate a couple minutes of your time to speak with you this evening. I want to specifically reach out to Dr. Prater and thank you for your leadership on this issue and your willingness to come to the table, work on a deal like I think you said perfectly. It's not a perfect deal yet. It's a deal that all 3 districts, I think, can live with. And I also want to thank the board for your consideration of this MOU tonight. I will be recommending approval tomorrow night at our board meeting in Cayucas, and it'll be up to the board to determine how they want to proceed. And then we also, if your board sees fit to approve it tonight and Cayucas board sees fit to approve it, we expect it to go before Coast Unified's board on February 8th. And so we thank you for your consideration.
I would just also like to point out that we, the board, had a study session a week ago, and those trustees who are absent tonight were present at that study session, where this was also quite thoroughly discussed. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to speak to this? Please state your name. Also.
My name is Amy Higgins, and I, being a local, I think this is a great idea. I don't know much about it. I did peek and check. Now that I've been paying extra attention to finances and budgeting, and obviously I have kids here for a long time, I did notice the special ed stuff within the contract, so I really appreciate that because I know that those expenses are really high. I was wondering how busing would work on something like that. If that's extended there.
There's no busing provided.
Okay, thank you. That's it.
Thank you.
Just like for any of our transfers from out of the district, so it's not just this particular situation, but we have students that live in Oro Grande, Grover Beach, other areas, and so they have to, part of the deal is that they have to provide their own transportation.
Yes, Dr.
Mr. Pinkerton, can you speak to the question of what would happen if one of the 3 parties withdrew and they lost their basic aid status and could no longer participate?
Well, I think like Ms. Sprint said, it basically would kind of, in terms of that, if you became a district that was a state-funded district, there would the incentive of having to do this would go away. So that's part of the issue right now is we receive these students with no money attached to them. So if we became state-funded, then money would follow from the state for those students. So you would try to, you know, take as many kids as you could potentially. So I think that's the gist of why this would potentially fall apart should that happen to one of the districts out of the 3. So it the wording kind of says, if you in the MOU itself, it says that if, you know, basically the district that falls out. So the question would be kind of, okay, well, what about the other 2 districts then that are still within the agreement? But I would say that in 14A, this agreement may be amended or terminated by mutual agreement as well. So that, you know, the modifications can be made, I think, by the other districts should that happen. Short of it, in the event that any of the parties loses basic aid, here it says such party may withdraw, and maybe Cayucas and Coast would want to continue that relationship in terms of allowing students 6th to 8th grade. That's something that those boards would have to decide. But it's not if the party leaves, the entire thing is gone.
Okay. Thank you. That answered my question.
Anything else? Dr. Prater, did you?
You know, it's an interesting dilemma. We did a pretty in-depth financial analysis on whether or not San Luis Coast would fall out of basic aid as a result of the loss of Diablo Canyon. And it appears that we won't. It appears that we'll hang on to basic aid, and helping that is also some of this more recent development in San Luis. And so my guess, and the new businesses that are coming into town. But my a more observant view that I've been practicing lately has to do more with the likelihood of a legislative response by and large across the state of California to eliminate community-funded or basic aid school districts entirely. And the reason I actually believe that is more likely going to be the case is because of the incredible distance, disparity between some basic aid school districts and revenue limit or LCFF districts. What I can tell you is that while more money has been going towards LCFF and it's going to be fully funded, which is fantastic, it really doesn't tell the whole story. When you look up and down the state, in San Luis Coastal is a low-wealth basic aid district. However, when you look up in the Bay Area, there are districts that I'm aware of that are spending upwards of $30,000 per kid. And just 4 miles away, there are districts that are spending a third of that per kid with 95% socioeconomically disadvantaged populations. I say to this board, that can't last. That will not last, I don't believe. At the next economic downturn in this state, I think there will be a lot of discussion around that. The amount of wealth that's concentrated in some of these communities, and they're allowed to, and oftentimes these communities also have parcel taxes on top of that, which is unbelievable. So what I will say to you is I think this MOU will likely carry us for the near future while the state reconciles that issue of the haves and have-nots. And in the meantime, I believe this addresses a more immediate issue that is confronted by the town of Cayucas and its students who wish to go to high school in another district other than Coast. And money follows those children. And so I believe this MOU is worthy of your consideration for those reasons, because any type of other response is going to carry with it a whole lot of discussion and pushback. I'm talking about unification issues with themselves or with another district. And so I believe that this MOU is expeditious, it's timely. It addresses a whole range of issues that we can all talk about and know about. And does it resolve it all? And are there still other questions that Ms. Friend mentioned? Sure. But I believe they're resolvable within the agreement itself.
Is my turn?
Yes.
Yeah, please. I want to be clear. I want people who are watching or who are listening in the audience to be clear about what we're really discussing here, because we're kind of talking around, and I don't think that the order of magnitude has been made clear. So I'd like to try to do that, if you would answer some questions for me, please. How many students... Are we aware of how many students, high school students, from Cayucas Coast is currently serving?
So,
from the Cayucas board, I'm hearing...
Kim actually has the IDT data,
yeah,
is right here.
Three.
It's on the board agenda.
Okay. So, okay, if this is actually on the board agenda, then it should be made clear. They have three students, and for those three students, they are receiving how much money from Cayucas?
You know,
one,
we We would prefer you not to speak from the audience, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at her. So the answer was, Dr. Brader?
Right now, the three students who attend Coast from Cayucas, Coast receives the entire apportionment of property tax from Cayucas, given that it's a basic aid district and the feeder school is Coast, and it's approximately $1.6 million.
So for three students, they are receiving $1.6 million.
Approximately.
And how many Cayucas transfer students are we currently serving at Morro Bay High School?
54.
And for which we are receiving what remuneration?
Currently?
Yes.
Nothing.
There's also six students at San Luis Obispo High School as well.
So we'll call it 60 students from Cayucas. We are educating on the dollar of the taxpayer in San Luis Coastal.
That is correct.
And this issue has been going on for a very long time, and we have never really said out loud, this is the number of students, this is the money, this is not right, although we have said it in conversation with the districts involved. So I really feel, you know, I feel that we need to reach some resolution that will cause the money from the property tax money from Cayucas to follow the students that are being served in San Luis Coastal. And while this agreement doesn't perhaps reflect fairness across the board, it's certainly a stab, and it's an effort that we're making and that we're hoping will be successful. I find it hard to look my constituents in the eye when I know, at least I'm a coastal trustee in Los Osos, there is a lot of struggle going on with people trying to incorporate the sewer costs into their household budgets, and then the thought that we're educating other people's students free of charge is just not tenable to me. I'm going to support this MOU, and I am really hopeful that the other districts involved will support it as well.
And Mrs. Roger, I appreciate, I made a note to myself about how to bring up the many, many years we have served these students with no reimbursement at all. And we've worked on this. This has been a work in progress. We have tried various approaches. We've come at this from different angles over the years. And this is the closest we've ever come to a workable solution. And we will need, of course, as has been stated, the approval from the other two districts. We're the first, our board meet, the way it's worked out, our board meeting is the first one to address this, to vote on this. And we will look forward to the support from Cayucas and Coast. So with that, Mrs. Rogers,
I just wanted to add, because what I had to say was so dollars and cents oriented, I do want to add that the students that we take from Cayucas, both at Los Osos Middle School and Morro Bay High School, are valued members of our school community. They're students that contribute. They're students that our kids play soccer with, play baseball with, have ties with in the community, outside of school. They are very welcome members of our community, and I don't want there to be any that anyone should think that I begrudge them coming. I do begrudge that we're not compensated for their education, but I know that they are very highly thought of and welcomed and loved in our schools.
Yes, we have definitely benefited from the involvement of these families over the years, and we appreciate that very much. We just are trying to make the whole situation right. So Thank you. So with that, we have it as a discussion action. We've had our discussion. It's time for action.
Yes, I move approval of the Memorandum of Understanding for Inter-District Transfers between Coast, Cayucas, and San Luis Coastal.
I'll second that.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right, now we have our elementary achievement report. Mrs. Shields.
Thank you. So tonight I'm going to share results from our elementary common assessments for the first trimester of the 17-18 school year. District common assessments have evolved over the past 7 years to a place where now both our math and writing assessments are aligned directly to our curriculum. In reading, our expectations for student proficiency at each grade level match the expectations of our district-adopted reading program. It's like we're really in a good place at this point with common assessments, where the results are able to inform both site and classroom planning, instruction, and intervention. For each subject area tonight, I will share end-of-first trimester results in three ways. I'm going to first of all give you a multi-year comparison for where we are at this time. I'm going to review the progress of our various student groups, in particular our LCAP student groups, and then we're going to take a closer look at the progress specifically of our socioeconomically disadvantaged student group from last year to this year at this time. And just as a reminder, this report is part of LCAP goals 1, 2, and 5. So we'll begin with mathematics. Students in grades kindergarten through fifth grade took the math trimester one benchmark assessment, which is aligned to our Bridges math program. A three-year comparison that you can see up there shows a growth of 14 percentage points overall, with a 10 percentage point growth from just last year. That's a good bit of news for this time of year. Factors that I believe have contributed to this significant growth include the fact that our students have now been learning with the Bridges curriculum for a number of years. In fact, our current fourth graders, Bridges is the only math program they know. I think our teacher efficacy in using Bridges has grown tremendously, and they are now also able to see the gains of a multi-year implementation. And articulation at school sites, at grade levels, and up and down the grade levels is very strong. So if we look a little deeper at this year's, I know it's a lot up here, and I'm going to walk you through it. Again, that's 69% of all students met the end of year first trimester expectations. If you look up there at that very top row, then you can also see an additional 20% of the all student group are approaching trimester expectations. A comparison of students in specific student groups shows us that 79% of our non-socioeconomically disadvantaged student groups have met or exceeded trimester expectations in math. This is representing 10 percentage points higher than the district overall. Going down the chart, you see 53% of our socioeconomically disadvantaged students have met trimester expectations. 45% of our English learners, 70% of our reclassified fluent English proficient students, and 44% of our students with IEPs have met or exceeded end of trimester expectations. The results at this time of year inform the work happening at our school site. Each of our elementary schools use their specific assessment results from the first trimester to review individual student progress, so they're able to align instruction, intervention, and resources for the next trimester. So let's take a look at that socioeconomically disadvantaged student group data just a little bit deeper. What you see on the bottom row is last year at this time, as compared to the top row shows this year at this time. As part of our LCAP, sites are intentionally focusing on the achievement gap of our socioeconomically disadvantaged student group. These two charts show you the comparison from last year to this year.
As you can see, there has been a 9 percentage point growth in meeting or exceeding trimester expectations, and equally as important, an 8 percentage point decline in the at-risk scores in mathematics from last time this year. We're encouraged by the data, and I believe it's a result of a very intentional focus at our school sites. So moving on to reading, you can see that, several year look, 27% of all students met end of year reading expectations, and an additional 54%, oh, I'm going too fast here, let me slow myself down. This is up just a small 3% from last year at this time. If I speak specifically to what's happening in reading in elementary, we're now in our second year of implementing our new curriculum. Teachers are developing more efficacy and competence. And first trimester data is really important to us because it allows us to be able to pinpoint where we need to focus our attention in the second trimester. So now let's take a little bit closer look at the various student groups. Again, you can see that 27% of the students have met the end of year. So this is the dark green that you see up there at the top. But equally as important is that 54% lighter green. These are students who met the trimester expectations, and we fully expect them by June to have met end of year expectations. Looking closer at specific student groups, you can see that 79% of our non-socioeconomically disadvantaged students have met trimester or end-of-year expectations. 53% of our socioeconomically disadvantaged student group, 44% of our English learners, 68% of our reclassified fluent English speakers, and 46% of our students with disabilities have already met first trimester expectations or end-of-year expectation grade level. Our end of first trimester benchmark results provide each of our school sites with the specific data that they need to plan, again, for instruction, intervention, and acceleration for the upcoming trimester. One of the biggest benefits we see in using the benchmark assessment system, or as we call it, the BAS, is that it can really help a teacher to understand exactly what the child has control of right now in reading to inform the very next steps for instruction. Our K-2 teachers will continue to focus on our at-risk students to determine who may need targeted in-class, one-on-one, or our leveled literacy intervention support during the second trimester. And again, let's take a look at our socioeconomically disadvantaged student group comparison from last year to this year. So far this year, you can see that 53% of our students in this group have met trimester benchmark or exceeded end-of-year grade level expectations in reading. When you compare this with last year at this same time, we're performing 7 percentage points higher with a decrease of at-risk readers by 8 percentage points. Again, this is without reading recovery, this is with leveled literacy, and this is with paying very close attention to good instruction in our classrooms. I think it's intentional, and I'm pretty happy about it. So let's move on to our third through sixth graders. They take what used to be called the SRI, the Scholastic Reading Inventory, and now it's called the Reading Inventory, or the RI. They take it at the beginning of the school year and again at the end of each trimester. This multi-year comparison shows we made a minimal increase in fall results from last year, with 62% of all students meeting or exceeding end-of-year proficiency. If we look a little bit more closely at the fall results, again, you can see that 62% met the end of year, while an additional 22% are approaching end of year expectations. This translates to meeting benchmark for this time of year. That would be where we want them to be. And although they're in yellow, not light green, we're pleased with the progress of these students. For our specific student groups, you can see that 78% of our non-socioeconomically disadvantaged students have met end-of-year expectations. For our LCAP groups, 38% of our SED, 9% of English learners, 59% of the RFEP, and 27% of our students with disabilities student group have met end-of-year proficiency, with an additional 30% for our socioeconomically disadvantaged, 34% for EL, 33 of our RFEP, and 22% of our students with disability student group are approaching grade level proficiency. The work for our sites is really about paying close attention to the at-risk group that you see over in the far right. As part of our reading units of study, ongoing professional development, you heard a little bit about it tonight from Mrs. McGrath, our teachers are learning how to use one-on-one conferring, just right texts, and developing text sets and toolkits to support their instruction in the classroom. And once again, let's take a closer look at our socioeconomically disadvantaged group as compared to last year. Here you can see that 38% have met or exceeded end of year, while another 30% are approaching grade level proficiency. We experienced a 3 percentage point increase, which is minor compared to last year, and a 4 percentage point decrease in our at-risk student group. Although it's not as high as our BAS, what we know and what I've been saying to you now for a number of years is that as children go up the grade levels, and especially third grade and beyond, it becomes that much more difficult to close that achievement gap. Let's move on to writing. Now in our fifth year of implementing the writing units of study, the data shows that 42% of this year's elementary, kindergarten through sixth grade students have already met end of year proficiency in writing. It's a 10 percentage point increase from last year at this time. It will be very interesting to monitor this data as we develop our expertise in teaching reading, because we know of the reciprocalness of the two. We expect that that will help us continue to grow in that area of writing. If we look at a closer look at our fall data, you can see again that 42% of our students have reached end of year, while another 44% met trimester benchmark and are well on their way to proficiency. And again, I'm going to read you through the kind of the additions of these. Our non-SED, or a non-socioeconomically disadvantaged student group, had 53% reach end of year proficiency, and another 39% met trimester benchmark. If you look at our LCAP student groups, you can see that 78% of our socioeconomically disadvantaged students, so I'm doing a little addition here, 75% of our English learners, 82% of our reclassified students, and 67% of our students with disabilities have met trimester benchmark or end of the year expectations at this time in writing. As in reading, teachers are focusing on our at-risk students to accelerate their writing proficiency. Teachers met at site this year to calibrate and collaboratively review student writing to identify next steps to support student growth. Since we all know writing is such a complex set of skills, there are many factors that may be impacting a student's writing level. Our next steps in supporting teachers include and improve their writing program is to research and then pilot quality materials to strengthen student grammar and punctuation skills. So finally, a closer look at our socioeconomically disadvantaged student group. You can see an 8 percentage point increase in students meeting end of year proficiency, and equally as important, a decrease of 8 percentage points of students in the at-risk group. This again is promising data for our socioeconomically disadvantaged students. In conclusion, our first trimester benchmark data provides us with a snapshot on our progress thus far. We know our students are engaged in rigorous, meaningful work in mathematics, reading, and writing. Our teachers and principals are delving deep into grade level and individual student data to plan and implement next steps for instruction, intervention, and acceleration. In the next couple weeks, principals will be meeting with Dr. Prater and myself to share their mid-year benchmark assessment data and the plans they've developed with their teachers for continued improvement. I'm encouraged by the positive outcomes for our socioeconomically disadvantaged students and the intentional focus sites are making to reduce the achievement gap. I want to remind the board that benchmark assessments are important for our district because they put all students on the same playing field with the same high expectations. When we set the expectations for all students and then measure where we are along the way by district, LCAP student groups, school, grade level, and most importantly, individual student, we're able to take an honest look at our progress and fine-tune our classroom instruction and interventions. District benchmarks provide a shared understanding of our grade-level expectations no matter what school a student attends. Ultimately, teachers' daily formative assessment practices in the classroom inform the day-to-day shifts in instruction. With that said, benchmarks serve as a district-level dipstick to make sure that we are all focused on the same goals. I look forward to sharing our end-of-year achievement results with you in June, and I'm happy to take any of your questions.
First, I believe we have someone from the public who wishes to speak to this.
Yes, Judy Neuhauser would like to speak, and I see that another hand went up, which was Becky Wells. So first Ms. Neuhauser and then Ms. Wells.
And hold on one moment, please, while we get our clock started.
I've got mine.
Oh, all right.
I have one. Go ahead, Judy. I've got mine started.
Yeah, but I can't see yours.
Oh, okay.
So I can't monitor my progress.
All right.
Sorry, Jim.
There we go.
Okay. My name is Judy Neuhauser. I'm really pleased to see progress on the testing, on the district assessments. I think that is really wonderful. I'd point out that you still can't tell yet whether you're closing the gap, because your data for 2016-17 hasn't pulled out the non-SEDs. So you compare how the SEDs have made progress to the SEDs from year to year, but you can't look at non-SEDs and SEDs and non-SEDs and SEDs over two different years. Did you catch what I said? Or are you confused? This is why I need to have my own data. It's why I need to be able to project graphs. Trying to discuss and graphs without actual graphs is really difficult. What I'm trying to say is 2016 data, if you're willing to put up one of the graphs, the 2016 data that they have does not have, it has total district, SED, ELs, and RFEPs. It does not have SEDs and non-SEDs. So you can't compare non-SED for 2016 to non-SED 2017 and look at their progress. Have they improved 20%? And then looking at what your SEDs have progressed. You can't tell that because we don't have the data for it. So I'm not saying that they haven't, but you don't know. And it sounds like the staff doesn't know either, because unless they've run it and aren't presenting it, we don't have that data. They could disaggregate the data, and then you could know. But you don't know until you've disaggregated the data. Thank you very much.
Ms. Wells.
I really appreciate all the graphs, and I appreciate all your hard work, Mrs. Shields, on everything. And I love our teachers, and I know that they are doing their hardest work and trying to fit everything in the day. But I have I've been asking for a couple years now. My child's in fourth grade. I think I've been doing this since he's been in first grade. I want to know where the science is. Why are we not focused on science, especially in 2018 when everything is science? Reading can be off of science. Math can be off of science. Where's the science? I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Anyone else from the public at this time? All right, we'll come back to the board. Any questions, comments? All right.
Actually, I do have one, Mrs. Shields. The numbers, the percentages for approaches, are you able to sort of define what approaches means in a teacher's mind?
Not quite there yet. Really, approaches, it's all based on the data that shows up. So where we use the word approaches, and this is where I want to look specifically at the graph that refers to approaches, and I believe it's the RI, the reading.
Yeah. I'm on demand writing is the one I'm on right
fine.
Now.
So that's a great one to explain. So we expect every child, our goal for every child is to reach a 3 on a scale of 4. 3 would be end of year proficiency. At this time of year in writing, we may have a child whose total score comes out a 2.5. They are progressing towards being a 3 by June. That makes sense?
Yes, yeah. It does.
So we're not worried about the 2.5, the kid that comes up with a 2.5 at this time of the year, because they're not done with writing. They're going to keep having writing instruction the rest of the year. So this is a great place for that child to be right now. 3 means they've already reached the end of year proficiency.
So if a child were a 2, would they be at risk, or would they still be in the approaches category?
I'd have to go and look at how it gets delineated now. And if I had my halftime assessment, Tosa, she could stand up and answer that for you. I can get that for you. I'm happy to share it with
you.
No,
I guess just what I want, Amy, what I'm trying to figure out is the percentage of students that is currently in the approaches position, mm-hmm. would it be the teacher's reasonable expectation that they will meet or exceed proficiency by the end of the year, and that's why they've put them in this approaches?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
They
have met what we consider benchmark for this time of year.
So they're well on their way.
Yes.
Okay. That's what I needed. Thank you.
And I would like to, I think this is where we use the term differentiated instruction, because we can obviously see that we have students at different levels within every classroom, I would mm-hmm. presume. So we have students who are already meeting or exceeding. So those students are receiving instruction that keeps them on a path that it doesn't just stop. It's like, okay, you can just sit at your desk for the rest of the year because you have met or exceeded, while the teacher uses mm-hmm. skills in differentiating to continue to pull the at-risk and nears or approaches proficiency mm-hmm. students along. So I think that's a testament to the training and professional development mm-hmm. and the talent of our teachers to be able to work with students at all those different levels.
I would agree with you and add to that, when you look at our reading curriculum and our writing curriculum, they're not based on a text that is just about getting to the end zone. They're based on developing competent and lifelong readers and writers. And so students are really never done. You never get that point where you say, I'm done learning, even if I've reached grade level or even if I've reached above grade level.
Well, I would hope that all of us in this room feel that way.
Absolutely.
I think, Mrs. Shield, what I heard you say anyway was that perhaps the progress that we're seeing has to do with pulling students that are struggling out of the room by not doing that, but keeping the students in the rooms at the various levels and with the development that we're doing with our teachers. I think we see this when we do our board walks mm-hmm. and we go into the classrooms, and every single child is engaged. They're mm-hmm. writing. They're helping each other write. They're shouting out the verbs and the adjectives and the things they want to say. And it's so it makes sense to me that we're seeing this kind of progress, even as we debated in years past whether mm-hmm. the pull-out programs were more important or not. And so I think we're getting some answers to those questions. Thanks.
And I have one more. I don't know if this is really a question, because I don't know that this is something that we're able to pull out. But I think that in the early years, we've got kiddos who've started with us and K-2 or so, but then as we progress, we have students coming into our district who've moved into our district and have, if they're EL or SED, their education has begun somewhere else, And that may, I wouldn't imagine it's enough to really skew numbers, but that is, there are kids into the mix who we don't have these isolated cohorts where we are following the exact same students throughout their career with us, mm-hmm. their educational career. So I think that's something that we have to, that teachers are having to deal with suddenly having a student new to our district who came from somewhere else, who may or came from a different country and are just now entering our district mm-hmm. at a different level of achievement in mathematics and reading and writing. So I know it occurs. I don't know to what extent, but
I certainly agree. Those are all additional challenges that our teachers face on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. All right, next is our presentation on student access to technology.
And Mrs. Sheffer, if you don't mind, as Mr. Kellish approaches, I just wanted to remind everyone that this was a board priority for us to look at student access of technology, especially for our socioeconomically disadvantaged students. And I know it was close to the heart for many of you as well. I want to just say kudos to Mr. Kellish for really looking at a variety of options and looking for different ways and being creative about how to help us begin to address this issue. So just wanted to remind you of that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Board, once again. It's good to be up front and to see all your smiling faces. And I know you all are very interested in what I'm about to present. I've kept it short and sweet today, so we'll just go over it. I know you probably have a ton of questions, so we'll just go from there. So first of all, student access to technology. Let me wait for it to queue up here real quick. I believe I have the clicker. Let me see if I can figure out this technology.
Put you to the test.
Yeah, if I fail this, I guess I'm out. So first of all, I use the BrightBytes data to help figure out how many students in our district had a need for they didn't have internet access at home. It was really hard for me to determine when reaching out and trying to figure out solutions what the district need was, and the only way I could get a finite answer was going to the BrightBytes data. And one of the questions in there was, do you have internet access at home? And then that was kind of the easier way for me to figure it out. I acknowledge that there's some questions about the data itself, but this is at least a baseline for us mm-hmm. to jump off from, right? So from there, I took the 644 students within our district and looked at different solutions that would work throughout the school district, right? So I tested all different types of technologies, all different types of solutions. I've listened to a bunch of community members. I've listened to other staff members about just the different solutions that would work. And really, we tested a lot of different solutions, but the one that worked the most was Chromebooks with mobile hotspots, okay? Now, with that being said, internet's spotty in different zones, and I acknowledge that. If you guys if you have a Verizon phone and you head off to Los Osos, it's questionable if you get a connection, right? And then there's also a spotty connection with other providers here inland. So it was really hard for us to find and choose a provider, and luckily T-Mobile was that solution provider where we drove cars around the whole school district, throughout the whole community, and we found that T-Mobile had the best connection and internet access throughout our school district service zone. With that being said, I had discovered through the process that T-Mobile had an Empower Ed grant or subsidy, and so I applied for it. I used all the data from the BrightBytes data. They told me that it would take between 30 to 45 days. We got a response within one day. And they fully funded us up to 650 students. So that subsidy covered 68% of the initial cost of the devices and the monthly data plans moving forward. This plan, to keep in mind, is specifically designed for this purpose. With that being said, one could think, okay, well, are we going to have to pay for the cost of the data during the summer months, right? No, we don't. This is specifically designed so when the students check the devices back in to the library during the summer months, we can actually pause the data plans and we do not incur or recur a cost. So just keep that in mind. They designed this specifically for this need. And it's been a great thing for us in that regard. So what's next? And I know I'm going quick. We can answer more questions. I'd love to in that regard. So what's next with us? As you can see, we received all the Chromebook devices. We've received all of the hotspot devices. They're sitting in my office right now. And we're going to work with the librarians to have them checked in and out. And so right now, next week, myself and one of my technicians, actually Brian here is in the crowd on a cell phone, he and I are going to go work with the librarians, and we're going to teach them how to pair the devices to the Chromebooks and to work with the students on how to do basic troubleshooting and then get them out the door. The other challenge that we have, and I've met with every single principal at the school district as well, and we've talked to them about figuring out how to identify these students. Because I can figure out the technology and I can figure out the program, but I can't really, from where I sit and my position within the organization, help identify. And that's where I need a lot of input from, you know, counselors, teachers, and staff and faculty just on how to identify it moving forward. And so we'll continue to work with the administrators and staff on how to identify these students. So short and sweet, keep it three, right? So there we go. Any questions, I guess?
Mrs. Roger. I don't have I guess I have one question, but
yes.
I am just thrilled that you have found this and that you have made it happen for us. It's been a huge concern of mine that we have our curriculum is technology dependent in many ways, and we have students who aren't able to access it. So I couldn't be happier, and I know that it's been a concern of Mr. Questenberry's as well. I'm sure all board members, but we've spoken up about it. I'm wondering, in the summertime, well, I imagine that when a student checks out a Chromebook and a hotspot in the fall and they check it back in June, that we would make accommodation for normal wear and tear. We don't expect it to come back in the pristine condition that it was.
Yeah.
And what if about students who want to attend summer school?
We can have those checked out again as well.
And the data plan.
Yeah. We just check them all in, and what we have in inventory, we can just disable the data plans during those times, and everything that's been checked out, we can still keep active.
Okay, great. So any student who wants to go to summer school and doesn't have a device or doesn't have connectivity at home can attend summer school and
That is correct.
This is really wonderful. Thank you so much.
So, and I would state that I think at various times every person on this board has expressed a deep and abiding interest in making sure that our students have the technology they need to perform at the levels we expect them to. Will this be managed by the sites? Will it be managed through your office? How will we make sure that the devices are in the hands of the students who need them, and how will this be tracked?
That's a great question. It will be managed by the sites, and primarily through the library.
Okay.
Because that's going to be the easiest way. Yeah. We've already tagged them all with barcode scans, so they can be checked in and out just like a book. And that's the easiest way for us to manage those assets when they travel out with the students, you know.
Okay.
And so each site and each site administrator will be responsible for their own Chrome and Chromebooks. I mean, mobile hotspots and Chromebooks. With that being said, if the 650 is a low number, right? We've already talked to T-Mobile about this, and they said all you have to do is fill out a one-page supplement form for whatever more you need.
Okay.
So then we can get more to more sites. And also these are district devices, not kind of site devices, so we can move them around per need and demand. Because the worst thing that I could ever imagine is having one inventory in a library somewhere where there's demand at another site somewhere else. Yeah. And that's a huge concern.
So one other question, and I know you're using we've gone with T-Mobile because you're stating it provides the best coverage. So I happen to live in a place where Verizon is the only thing that works. And when people come with their T-Mobile phones or AT&T or Sprint, they have to use either my phone or my landline. So on the for the few people, students who may live in areas where T-Mobile doesn't work, are they out of luck, or do we have any kind of backup?
Yeah, at this current time, I don't have any backup. I'm just trying to, you know, just get an initial rollout going.
Right, which I very much appreciate.
Yeah, and I acknowledge, too, we live in a very difficult area.
Yes,
we do. It's gorgeous. It has great rolling mountains and everything, but let's also be honest, the multi-billion dollar telecoms haven't figured out how to get coverage everywhere as well.
That's right.
And so that's a huge challenge, and I readily admit that for anything that we put out there. So we will probably have to find and spot check those students as well, and they'll report back to us it doesn't work, and then we could figure out a solution.
Okay.
We also have 15 other Sprint devices as well, mobile hotspot devices we could deploy out there as well.
So that leads to my question that if a student reports back that I have this, it still doesn't work, then you will receive that information and come up with a plan B for those particular students.
We're going to say, yeah, we're going to come up with an action plan. I thought he was going to say something.
No, I'm going to say something.
Go ahead.
I just want to kudos to Jeremy.
Oh, no,
650 students are going to have a computer.
Yeah, this is awesome.
And potentially internet access. I mean, this was a huge board goal. Like, I mean, you guys have been talking about this for a long time, concerned and what's going to happen. And Jeremy made this happen with Kim's help. We didn't have a budget for this.
Yeah.
We didn't have, you know, in terms of looking at it, and to be able to get this done was, pretty substantial.
Yeah,
so
no, this is awesome.
A lot of the Google stuff, too, just so you know, even without the internet, just having the computer itself at home is a key aspect of it. So I just wanted to put my little prop.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that.
Awesome.
I think I speak for the board when we say we're very impressed and happy about this. So any other comments at this time? Yeah, you need to come up to the microphone and please. Oh, you need to speak into the microphone.
Could you repeat your name?
Lene Coyner, Morro Bay High School. What if a student wants to keep it over summer? Right.
I should probably talk into the mic as well. I don't know, and that's going to have to be up to the site administrators.
Do you have the other 32%? This covers 68% of the cost. You have. I mean, you said there was no budget for that, but you have the other 32% somewhere. Since you already have them here, obviously it was paid for.
So we do have a replacement budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, he said that it covered 68% of the. So the other 32%, we do have somewhere.
We do. And just something else to clarify is, can you use it in the summer? It can only be used for educational purposes, right? So to Ms. Rogers' question, if a student was in summer school, that it would be easy to justify that could be utilized for an educational purpose. If the student is just now like, this is great, I'd love to keep it over the summer, probably not. It has to be educational purpose only.
Yes.
Judy Newhouser. I really do appreciate the district taking these steps. I've had many students when I taught at Monarch Grove who did not have internet access. And going to ELAC meetings after I retired, there were students, parents who were saying that their kids were having to run around to different friends' houses trying to use their computers because they didn't have access to it. They couldn't do their homework. Which brings me to another point. Access to books, especially math books. I was talking to it's an ex-student of mine. He's now in eighth grade. His mother has had problems trying to get books from the district, from his teachers, and has had to fill out all sorts of forms and this and that and the other just to get him books because he doesn't work well on a computer in math. And he does much better when he has a textbook and he can work pencil and paper. And so I want to make sure that in the rush to all the technology, we don't ignore the fact that there are tasks that computers are beautifully designed for and tasks that they're not so good at. There was a study out of the London School of Economics and Political Science, and I want to read a short quote. It said, They discovered that there were times that pencil and paper were more appropriate, and digital tools clearly excelled in other areas. And here's the quote. One of the reasons some students favor handwriting is the role it plays in learning and retaining knowledge. Many of the students in our study found that making handwritten notes leads to a greater retention of data than if it's typed. When people type their notes, they have a tendency to try and take verbatim notes and write down as much of the lecture as they can. The students who are taking longhand notes in our studies are forced to be more selective because you can't write as fast as you can type. And that extra processing of the material that they were doing benefited them in their recall. She goes on to say that students also expressed difficulties in writing mathematical and scientific formulas and graphs on computers. They noted that searching for information, correcting typed material, spell checking, and legibilities were all the advantages of the digital, but that there are places where it may not be the appropriate tool, and I want to make sure that we allow our students access to paper and pencil and books if that's how they work better. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Thank you very much for a very informative and gratifying presentation. All right, our next topic is 7.05, proposed revisions to Board Policy 1325, Community Relations, Advertising, and Promotion. This is the first reading.
Thank you. This evening I bring forward Board Policy 1325. This is Community Relations and Advertising and Promotion. So you will find within this policy the changes in purple are the suggestions and ideas submitted from the Board Subcommittee that has reviewed this policy. The changes in red, you'll note, began with suggestions from GAMET and CSBA have also been reviewed by the Board Subcommittee. You can see that in purple, there's been some clarification and addition of parent and guardian support. GAMET suggested a removal of one line, and a lot further clarification on that follows. On the back page, you will notice that the board subcommittee suggested a line to show that we would not accept distribution unless it was following administrative regulation. And then there was a lot of detail in this board policy, and it was suggested that that be considered for AR. So tonight this is first reading for you to either choose to adopt or to bring back for second reading.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to address this board policy? Okay. Seeing none, we'll come back to the board.
I just want to express my interest in having this come back to the board for a second reading so that we have a more complete board, and I'll probably say the same for the next board policy also. Okay.
And I just wanted to clarify for myself that in reading this policy, and I think the answer is probably obvious, but although there can't be any kind of political campaigning on our campuses. If someone such as the League of Women Voters or a like group wanted to disseminate information to high school seniors encouraging them to register to vote, would that be precluded under this policy?
They are allowed to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Is everyone in agreement to bring this back for a second reading? All right. Mrs. Holmes, will you so note that this will come back at our next agenda? And item 7.06, proposed revisions to Board Policy 6142.1, Instruction, Sexual Health, and HIV AIDS Prevention. This also is the first reading. Ms. McGrath.
Thank you. Yes, along the same lines, you can see a lot of clarification and additions in red. God bless you, suggested from GAMET that you would see in red noted there, has been reviewed by the board subcommittee. The second paragraph you will see is suggested from GAMET as well as the board subcommittee noted information there. Some clarifications from the board subcommittee as well as eliminating some of the information and adding better wording and rewording. You can
see quite a few suggested additions from Gamut. And again, I assume this could be brought back for a second reading.
Is there any discussion at this time? Or I forgot to go to the public. Anyone from the public wishing to address this particular policy? Mrs. Roger?
I just wanted to note that in the section that is described as moved from the end of the document, the board recognizes that lack of information or misinformation may contribute, I believe we wanted two in there, to an increased risk for sexually transmitted diseases.
Yes.
That's just housekeeping. But then I had to go over this with my husband, because therefore the district's curriculum shall help students understand the biological, psychological, social, moral, and ethical aspects of human sexuality. And the way I read that, I was thinking, well, I don't know that we want to be discussing the moral aspects or the ethical aspects, but my husband suggested that that was referring to transmission of HIV and the moral and ethical.
It goes with, right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anything else? All right, and you have two children. You need it. All right, we'll bring these both back at
Thank
our
you.
Next meeting. Thank you. Next, we have notice Measure D, approved notice of completion for the Morro Bay High School swimming pool.
They're swimming.
They're swimming.
It's done.
It's
so this basically, by doing the notice of completion, basically kind of sets in the process of the final paying of the retention and the bills and kind of closing up that project. And it's a beautiful pool.
It is a beautiful pool. Anyone from the public wishing to address this item? All right. Bring it back here. Mr. Quisenberry.
I'll move approval of the notice of completion for the Morro Bay High School swimming pool.
And I'll second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Yay. All right. Thank you. Next, 7.08, approve board member pay for permissible absence.
Yeah, I would like.
Can she not vote on her?
There's not an official requirement for Catherine to abstain, but if she would prefer to, then we can defer this to the next agenda.
Oh, you want to abstain? You don't need to. We can go ahead and vote. You don't.
Yeah.
There's nothing, no requirement that you abstain. That's what Mrs. Holmes was saying.
So what's happening? Let me just so Dr. Eisendrath Rogers was ill during the board study session last week and was unable to attend. And what this is, and it's allowed in Section A8 of our Education Code 35120. For the board to approve such absences, and illness is one of those reasons. And I'm just requesting that the board acknowledge that. This is no precedent. This is well known throughout.
Anyone from the public wishing to address this? I will come back. Mrs. Rogers?
I'll move approval of item 7.08.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Yes. You need to vote, or we need to. Yes. Okay. Next is our action consent agenda. Please let me know if you'd like anything pulled. 8.01, approve updated job description, Director of Learning and Achievement. Point 02, approve new program specialist salary schedule and revised teacher salary schedule. 8.03, approval of warrants and payroll. 8.04, approval of purchase orders and CalCard purchases. 8.05, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 8.06, acceptance of donations. 8.07, approve comprehensive school safety plans, and I'm going to pull that. 8.08, Measure D, addendum to mediated mutual release and settlement agreement. I believe she already did. So we are seeking a motion for 8.02 through 8.06 and 8.08.
I'll move approval of items 8.02 to 8.06 and 8.08.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Mr. Quisenberry.
I just have a question on the job description. We currently have a director. Is this in anticipation of future candidates for that job?
Correct. This is when Amy Shields, our elementary director, when she retires, unfortunately, this summer, we will be replacing. This is why this position is redone the way it is. So
Amy, look sad. Look sad.
As the board should know, we did not replace the secondary director. When Mr. Robinette retired, Mrs. McGrath left the secondary director and technology director position and was promoted to the assistant soup position. We did not replace that position. She just carried the work with her. And Mrs. Shields, when she retires, our plan is to more seamlessly integrate it into a K-12 role.
So it's going to be a consolidated position. Thank you.
Yeah.
I move approval then of item 8.01.
All in favor?
Aye.
And I just pulled the school safety plan item just to confirm. Sometimes in the past we've been presented with the plans, and it's my understanding from a conversation with Dr. Prater that there were no major changes made to any of the plans this year, so we were not presented with them. Well, we can look at them, but to go through and comb through each site's plan this year. Is that correct? I just want to confirm that.
Yeah, that is correct. So it's basically what happens. We actually updated all the plans, I believe, about a year ago and brought all that to the board, went through them all. Chris Dowler was here, talked about everything. So really the meat of the plan is exactly the same.
Okay.
Fire drill, earthquake drill, evacuation routes, those types of things. We do update the data around arrests on campus and police call, those types of things. And then really the key for this is that the board knows that this has gone through the school site council process, and the new school site council has signed off and approved it. So we have those, you know, signatures on there and the dates, and it just kind of covered an annual update. I mean, okay. We actually for a while weren't even kind of keeping up in terms of this. I'm making sure, and Mr. Dowler, thanks to Mr. Dowler for pulling all the sites together, is making sure that this is annually coming to the board.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. So with that, I will move approval of 8.07, approve comprehensive school safety plans.
I will second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. All right, next we have, does anyone have anything for the advance agenda? Moving on, reports by board members. Wish to make a report this evening? All right, then this meeting is concluded. Our next meeting will be February 13th, our next regular meeting here in J2. Thank you very much.